Magic,
and the world of illusion.
Magic TV
and Craig Petty proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It's 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic, and I am excited. I'm excited because I have been a huge fan of this gentleman's career for a very, very long time. He bought a book out many years ago that I still say is one of the best books on magic for somebody getting into magic, a new person getting into magic. I think that this book is incredible. And a creator, a performer, an innovator, a super nice guy. If you went to the Blackpool Magic Convention this year, you probably saw him there. I am, of course, talking about the legend, the one and only Diamond Jim Tyler. How are you doing, man? Are you okay?
Life is awesome. Thank you. Things couldn't be better.
Thank you for jumping on the channel. I really appreciate it. I know you're busy performing. You're busy doing shows. You're out there. So thanks for finding time to do this. I really appreciate it.
No, it's fun. I like watching your channel, and I'm a fan of you as well. So
this is great. And I genuinely have been wanting to interview you for a long time, because for me, you're one of the, when I was really focusing on learning my craft, your material and a lot of the stuff that you was doing and still are, was a big influence on the direction that I took me and my character and my magic. So you've been a huge influence on my career for a very long time. So the fact that I've had the chance to do this interview is amazing.
Thank you. Well, you know, most of my work, I've stood on the shoulders of giants and hopefully taken some of their ideas a little further. And that's what we all want. So it's exciting for me to see how far you've taken things. And, you know, so thank you too.
You're more than welcome. And I can't wait to find out a little bit more about you, because obviously I know you through your work. I'm aware of a lot of the routines that you've created and released and publicized over the years. But it's going to be very interesting to find out more about you as well. And on that subject, for anybody who doesn't know who Diamond Jim Tyler is, we're going to start at the very, very beginning. In other words, how did you get into magic, Jim, and what is your origin story?
So when I was born, my father was a pool hustler, and my mom, I think she worked for Sears. And as a little kid, my grandmother would give me playing cards every time she saw me, because I like to make card houses. It's how I learned to count, how I learned my colors. And then, so I could handle a deck of cards pretty well at the age of two. And so my dad eventually left the pool hustling life because he got stabbed and decided to get a real job. So I've always, for my dad, I've always had a little bit of that hustler mentality. And so when we went to Disney World, when I was 5 years old, I saw a book in the magic shop, and it spoke to me. It was like 113 Easy to Perform Miracles with an Ordinary Deck of Cards. It was called Magic with Cards by Frank Garcia and George Schindler. I recommend that book highly, because there's nothing really sleight of hand. It's not sleight of hand heavy. It's more story driven and mathematical. And so I was very, very introverted as a child, and, you know, would play with my cards. And that book taught me how to be more outward. And because to do the routines, you had to become a performer. And so I started showing everybody what I could do with cards. And of course, once you get that adulation from others, you know, you want more of that. And so I mastered like everything in the book. Like I could do over 100 card tricks by the time I was seven. And like I say, I think the hardest move in the whole book was the glide. And that was it. So that was my catalyst.
Incredible that you could do all of that magic at the age of seven. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and I had like 100 decks of cards, so I knew you know, but I was always at two, I was handling a poker sized deck of cards. There's a picture of me. I should find it. It looks like I'm doing a one-handed cut. I'm not, but I've got a weird grip around a poker sized deck. I think it's on my website, on my biography page. Oh, wow. And I'm in my diaper with my cards in my hand and I'm going like this, and I'm not saying peace. I'm saying, you know, it's a two that I'm holding or whatever. So,
wow, that's so good.
So then, after that, I found a magic shop as a teenager and I started buying a lot of things from them. And I went into a restaurant. It was called Tia's. It was a Tex-Mex restaurant. And, you know, back in the day in high school, I needed a job to pay for my car. And so I told them, hey, I can do magic for your guest. And they said, well, we want you to put on this clown suit and this wig. I go, nope, I ain't doing that. You know, this is me telling them no. And this is my first job. And I said, I do magic. I'm not a clown. And the guy said, well, here's $100, you know, go pick out like a tuxedo or something. And so I went to this used tuxedo shop and I don't know what I was thinking, but I bought like a white tuxedo jacket because that was kind of the fashion, the style. And I'm working in a Tex-Mex restaurant, right? And so the story gets funnier. So I was still green. I knew a lot with a regular deck. But since I've been to the magic shop a lot, I had all these cool trick decks that would do different things. And so every time I perform for a group, I pull out this trick deck and put it away and pull out another trick deck and do another trick. And I go, why do you need a different deck of cards every time you show us a trick? And I go, oh, okay, maybe I need to go back to doing what I used to do and just doing card tricks with normal cards. And that grew to, you know, learning other types of magic as well beyond card magic. But what I was going to say that was I thought was funny was after about a month or so of wearing just the tuxedo and getting stains all over this white tuxedo that was constantly having to clean, the manager said, you know what? You're missing something. I don't know what it is, but you need something. He's like, maybe a mask. And I was like, a mask? And so at the time, I went to Magicland and bought like a white Lone Ranger mask to match my jacket. And I would put that on in the restaurant and I'd walk up to the tables and they'd be like, Nigga! You know, they jump back when you walk up to their table, or the kids would start crying, you know, because this masked man's at the table. And I tell the guy after about a week of that, I was like, dude, this ain't working. This is just scaring people. It's having the wrong effect. And so eventually he started listening to me more and I kept that job for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 9 months before I started parlaying that into other private parties and other restaurants. And so that's a lot of my origin story right there. Is just I had the balls to walk into a restaurant and go, I could do magic for your guests. And what's cool is I was making more money than all my friends. I think I was getting like maybe $10 an hour, but I was doing 9 hours a week plus tips, plus free food. So I was making, you know, probably a few hundred dollars each weekend.
Wow.
And but working 9 hours when I was 16. So doing restaurant magic.
And on that subject, so obviously you're in school, you're doing restaurant magic. I've got so many you're in high school, you're doing restaurant magic. I have so many questions. One of the questions is, when did you start creating magic? And the reason I ask that is I know a lot of the material that you've put out over the years, and I seem to remember a lot of your early material, especially, was the sort of magic that you would see in a restaurant. I remember Sweet, which was your routine where you had something go in a sweet and low packet. And that was just perfect for restaurant workers. Was that developed from working in restaurants when you were in high school, or did that come later on?
It came later. After I started doing restaurant magic, the magic shop owner said to me, he said, dude, he said, you should just work here. He said, you know how everything works already. He goes, and you know, when you work here, you get a 20% discount. I was like, discount? So he had me hooked. And so I started working for the magic shop and doing the restaurant magic at night. I was doing like 8 restaurant shifts a week at one point. I was doing one every night and twice on Sunday and working the magic shop.
Wow.
And so when you're doing 8 restaurant shifts a week, you get good. Like if you're doing 20, 30 tables a night, imagine doing the same routines over and over again. Well, I learned to listen to my audience because they would say, hey, can you do this? Can you do that? And I think, how could I do that? And I wanted to do magic with my surrounding, what was around me. I liked magic to seem organic. Like I had magic with the ketchup bottle or their spoon. And the sugar packets always bothered me because they were always on the table. But I really didn't have a trick other than vanishing it in a thumb tip. And so I thought there's got to be a way to get a borrowed coin or a side ring inside one of those sugar packets. And so it's something I actually thought about for 10 years. Like, what would be the best method? And I came up with different methods. And then one day it just hit me because my idea didn't use up any pocket space, zero. And it looked like when the effect was over that it was in the packet that was there before I ever got there, you know? And part of the how I learned what people wanted and what people liked was I was a little bit sneaky. I don't know if you can get away with this today. But I had a little recorder like that would I could hide in a card box. And so I punched a bunch of holes in this card box, closed it. And as I would hand them my business card, I would leave it in the middle of the table and it record. And I'd walk away because when you're at the table, they say the nicest things. They're like, you're the best. You're awesome. I don't know how the hell you did that. But when you walk away, the truth comes out. They're like, I saw that coin in the hand. Or... like when I used to do the torn corner, I would do a torn corner switch and have the card or the bill reappear in an impossible location. Well, as I would leave, they would go, man, I don't know how he did it, but he must have switched that corner. That's the answer. Mm. And so lay people are not as dumb as we think sometimes. And so after that happened, I thought to myself, it's got to be a sign thing always. It can never be a torn corner. I've never done a torn corner since I was like 20 years old. It's always assigned something, but that's because I listened to the intel I got from the recorder, from listening to people's conversations about what I should cut, what was strong, what wasn't strong. So,
wow. So you're working full time basically in a magic shop. Was that the goal? Right, I finished school. I want to do magic for the rest of my life. Was that kind of the thing?
No, because. All the people that I knew that did magic did children's shows. Now, I made money, good money, doing kid shows, but it was never my first true love. I wanted to be something different. It just wasn't for me. But I've done a lot of kid shows and, you know, over the course of time. And so I just thought to myself, well, if that's the way you got to make money with magic, then I need a real career. And so I worked my way through college doing magic, doing restaurant magic. My degree is in criminology and criminal justice.
Wow.
My whole plan was to work for the government, for the Secret Service, and go after counterfeiters because I knew a lot about that subject, more than I am willing to tell people. And so I took a lot of psychology courses, but the last year I was in college, I learned that I had cancer. I had Hodgkin's disease.
What?
And yeah, so I had to drop out of college, take care of my cancer. I had to have my spleen removed. I had to have radiation treatments. And when you go through something like that, everyone always says, oh, I'm so sorry. It was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me because it fine-tunes your focus. Like you really realize what is important in life when you have to go through something like that. And so I thought, well, you know what? If I'm going to die, magic has been good to me. I'm going to see how far I can take it. And so I started competing in magic competitions and I started winning. I wrote Pockets Full of Miracles. And as you know, it did well. And so I'm thinking, well, maybe this magic thing is, you know, I tell people all the times that being a magician, a professional magician, is like being a priest. Many people are drawn to it, but very few people are chosen. And I feel like the more I tried to get away from magic, the more it drew me back in. Like, this is my calling. This is what I'm supposed to do.
Oh, wow. So when you wrote Pocketbook Full of Miracles, you weren't full-time at that point. That was something that you were moving towards, is that?
I guess I was full-time. I was paying my way through college doing restaurant magic.
Oh, wow. So you were still in college when you wrote Pocket Full of Miracles. I didn't even know that.
No, I had just gotten out. I was out of college. So I'm trying to think when I graduated from college. That would have been like I had to drop out in 93. I think I went back in 94 and finished my degree. I had the degree. And then I worked for the Texas Youth Commission for a short while. That's for juvenile offenders that have committed serious crimes, murder and such. And like I said, I studied psychology even more because I want to always know what makes people tick. Why did these kids commit murder? And actually what I found fascinating was the murderers in the halfway house that I was, working with. They were the nicest kids out of all the kids in the whole lot. The burglars and the rapists, those were the kids that were demented and messed up. Murder is usually a crime of passion. Mm. And it's not like in the movies where there's serial killers on every corner. But the kids who had created some more heinous crimes, like sex crimes, those kids, there's something going on wrong in their head. And also, I think they thought they had to be a little bit tougher and meaner than the murderers. The murderers were trying to redeem themselves. Anyway, that's a topic for another discussion. But no, I've always wanted to know what makes people tick and what makes people remember things. So in my magic, I try my hardest to do magic that will stick in their head, not till tomorrow, but for the next 10, 20 years. Like when you make a sign, coin, or a ring appear in a sugar packet that was on the table before you got there, they're going to remember that for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
They will forget your four ace routine by lunch tomorrow. So I try to really study psychology and remember what people, sticks with them. So I also study why things are famous. I'm always interested why everyone thinks the Mona Lisa is the most famous painting or why King Tut was the most famous Pharaoh. And so I've studied these things to figure out the patterns. So,
and do you study them so that you can improve your magic and you can use them from a presentational point of view? Because this is fascinating. Nobody's ever, in all the interviews I've done, nobody's ever talked about this before. And this is really fascinating.
No, I do. I study it from a presentation standpoint and to use what I think Kenton Nepper, called, wonder words, or neurolinguistic programming, things that I can say and do during my performance to hopefully cement that moment in their mind for the rest of their life, and do effects that are frozen in time, like a bent coin or a card on a ceiling or a thing inside of an impossible object or things that happen to them personally. Things people care more about themselves and their name than they do anything else. So if you can incorporate their name or get them to help where the magic happens to them and not to you, they'll remember that forever. So those are the things that I want to create. So,
wow, that's amazing. And backtracking a little bit, let's talk about Pocket Full of Miracles before we move on with your career, because I talked about how amazing that book was, but writing a book is a big undertaking, King. Like, it's not a little thing, it's huge. What made you decide to go, I'm going to write a book? How did that come about?
So I'd been doing restaurant magic for, 10 years or so. And I won't mention his name because I really do look up to him. He used to throw me some gigs and cover some of his restaurant gigs. And I told him that I wanted to write this book. And he said, you have no business writing a book. You don't have enough experience. I think you need to wait. And I was just like, wait? Wait for what? Like, I have knowledge that I want to share now, and I want to get this, out of my head onto paper, or I'm going to lose it. And so I think whenever I have naysayers that tell me I shouldn't or couldn't do something, that makes me want to do it all the more. Mm. And so it lit a fire into me. And plus, I had a mentor. His name was Louis Zaffron. And Lou was kind of like, he was in his 80s and I was in my 30s. And Lou was like the Dive Vernon of Dallas, you might say. He invented the best watch winders and had this funny thing called a tire pressure gauge where you hit the thing and the thing would shoot out. And I had the pop-up ties. But his card magic was phenomenal. His coin magic was phenomenal. And he reminded me a lot of Walt Disney. He just had that twinkle in his eye. And so I told him about my book idea. He's like, Jim, you have so many great ideas. You need to write this stuff down. And so I wrote the first chapter, which was The Gunslinger, which is you would draw a cowboy on a card and you'd bend it and put it, you know, 15 feet away from you or 12 feet away from you, and you make a gun with your finger and shoot it. And when you shoot it, they heard a kapow that came out of nowhere. And then the card would fall over dead. And then you pick it up and there'd be a bullet hole through the card. And so I wrote that up and called him to tell him so, and found out that he had died. He had passed away, and he was my best friend. And so I thought, okay, I got to write this book for Lou. And so I finished the book. His nephew was a restaurant magician in Dallas named Jeff Davis, who's still one of my best friends. He lives in California now. And Jeff was the guy I always wanted to be. He was just well-dressed, lots of jokes. His magic was solid. And Lou was his uncle. And so I got Jeff to write the introduction to the book. And at the funeral, I met his son, and his son was an editor. So I got Lou's son to edit the book. And so when that book came out, it's 29 different routines, from cards to coins to mentalism, lots of jokes. But then the back is a glossary on every sleight of hand move that you use for each routine throughout the book. There's a spellbound routine. And so I think that's what made it unique, is the just the fun material that was restaurant friendly. And then two, the glossary in the back that was like a crash course in close-up magic.
Yes, I remember, I've got the book over there, the glossary at the time, I was thinking, why aren't more magic books doing this? Because the problem with a lot of magic books is you buy them and they're not that accessible. They'll reference a sleight which you have to go and hunt down somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And you'll reference a move or a sequence that you have to go check somewhere else. And having that glossary is just a brilliant idea, to be perfectly honest. It really is.
And two, I wanted a seasoned magician to be able to read it. And if it says, do the Elmsley count, he could just read past it. He wouldn't have to learn the Elmsley count, you know, in the routine. So I put all that in the back of the book for those that didn't know what those terms meant. And so that book did really, really well. And it made me kind of a name in the magic community, which I was not expecting at all. And then shortly after that, it was time to turn it into a video. And so I, at the time, L&L was the biggest game in town. Mm-hmm. And so I approached them and I said, you know, this is what I like to do. And they made me an okay offer. And then I approached Magic Smith, Chris Smith, and his offer was five times better. And I got to be more involved in the process. And so I chose Chris. The problem was, when it came out, he released it as a double VHS set. And that's when VHS sets were going out and DVDs were on the rise up. And so I pestered him for a couple of years, like, dude, you got to put it on DVD. You know, nobody wants this. And so he got tired of hearing me bothering him. So he sold me back the rights and I released it on DVD, and it fast became one of my best-selling DVDs. So
that's amazing. And would you, I mean, just as a side note on that, would you ever bring that back out again as like a download now that DVDs are on the way out?
Well, what I've done is I've turned a lot of them into individual downloads, but I want to reshoot them all because they're all dated. This was all filmed like in 2000. And we had the one microphone that was on the camera. I wasn't mic'd up. So it sounds pretty good, but not great. So, and of course, some of them I have turned into separate downloads, like my animated card box, the box that comes to life in your hand. Mm-hmm. That I made a separate DVD and download called Telekinetic. But yes, I want to turn more of them into more updated downloads. And I'd like to do that soon.
Amazing. Well, before we carry on talking about your creations, because there's a lot more to talk about. Obviously, these days, you don't really do restaurants. You do a lot of corporate work and sort of private events. Is that right?
That's true. I do try to always keep one restaurant where I'm doing at least one night a week somewhere. Okay. Because that allows me to keep fresh and always be working on new material. It's a place to test things. And two, to be honest with you, it's the only place my friends and fans can really come see me, because they don't want to pay me to come to their party. They can't afford it. And so I can't afford me. Yes, like this weekend, I did 4 gigs. You know, it was Father's Day weekend, but I had 2 shows yesterday and two shows on Saturday. And I think this last December I had 30. It was my busiest December ever, all corporate gigs.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, now I've performed in all 50 states and 31 other countries. And when I did Blackpool this year, that was my third time lecturing and performing there. So
That's incredible. So two questions on that. Number one, in terms of restaurant work, mm-hmm. I know a lot of people, I speak to a lot of people that are getting into magic and they want to start doing restaurants, but they don't really know how to get that restaurant gig, land that restaurant gig. Unfortunately, there's not much advice out there anymore. I remember back in my day, we had Magic Menu and things like that, which was
I remember.
Amazing. Magic Menu was amazing. But these days, we don't have anything like that. So for anybody who wants to land restaurant gigs, as somebody who's done an awful lot of them, more than most people, is there any advice that you have about how to actually secure a restaurant booking?
Yeah, I have lots of advice. One, it's best to never, in my opinion, to go after a chain. Because when you approach, let's see, do y'all have, name a chain there.
Oh, in the UK, Restaurant Group is one of the biggest ones. You got Frankie.
Okay, Bear. Well, I'm saying if you approach anybody in Restaurant Group, then they've got to talk to the district managers, or the general managers talk to the district manager. They're going to talk to, and by the time it gets to them, we're like, magician, what? No, we don't need to do that. So it's best to walk into a restaurant that's a singly owned restaurant, or it's a small chain. That way you can actually talk to the boss. And also restaurant managers and owners, they can, you know, people can smell desperation. So if you walk in, you're like, hey, I want to, you know, they don't want to be hustled. They don't want a desperate performer. So what I've learned, the best thing to do is go have dinner at the place that you would like to perform. And just be nice and perform some magic for the manager, for the waitress, for some people around you. And then they're like, oh, this is really cool. And then you leave them your card and say, hey, why don't I come and talk to you sometime about, you know, how magic works in restaurants. And then you've got an in. They already know you. They already like you. Then when you show up for the meeting, you can pitch it. And when I say pitch it, I mean sell them on a free night where I go, look, why don't you let me come in for one night for a couple of hours? Maybe you buy me dinner and you see how much the people enjoy this. And the way this works is they spread it by word of mouth that you've got a magician here. And all of a sudden they want to come back for more and other people want to come back and see it. And eventually I'll pay for myself. You know, you'll be profiting from it and they're getting free entertainment. That's what everybody wants. They want to go out, have a nice meal and be entertained. You're bringing the entertainment to them table side. I was never one who ever worked for tips. So I don't recommend do that. You've got to be worth something. They have to have a value on you. I don't know what to tell them to charge. You know, you got to figure out what your time is worth, but it's not going to be what you get for a corporate gig or a private party. I'll tell you that. the deals that I usually made was, let's say I charge, I'm just making up a number, let's say I charge $500 an hour, I would only charge the restaurant 25% of that if they had me on a regular weekly basis. So that would only be, what, $125 or whatever for a couple hours. Yeah, or that, it's more than that. I mean, or 250, or no, 250 is half, so 125. 125 is low.
For an hour, 2 hours would be 250, which you said.
Yeah. So 250 in a meal, you know. I actually get more than that, but I'm selling them on the fact they're not getting just any restaurant magician. They're getting a restaurant magician who's done this for 30 plus years. I've written books on the subject, et cetera. So by the time they, like the last gig I sold, and when I walked in and I pitched it, they were like 5 minutes later, like, let's do it. I go, I haven't even told you how much. They're like, we don't care. Because they were convinced that I was the right guy for the job. So
that's amazing. That's fantastic. And transitioning away from restaurants, obviously, you do a lot of corporates now. Do you find it different doing a corporate or a private party or something like that compared to working a restaurant? Is it a completely different skill set?
Yes and no. With the restaurants, your timing has to be impeccable. You know, you want to hit them at the right time, just after the menus are taken away while they're waiting for their food. You never want to tie up the table at the end of the meal because they want to turn those tables to get other people in there. Whereas if you're doing walk around at a party, you know, you can approach them just about any time. I even have magic that I do while people are eating, because a lot of what I do is visual, where they can just think of something or point to something. I don't have to physically touch anything. But I don't like to do magic when people are eating, because I do like them to be hands-on and have magic happen in their hands, and not for me to be towering over them while they're seated. I much prefer them to be standing, like a cocktail kind of hour, or doing stand-up for everyone. I do as much stand-up as I do close-up strolling magic. I do a lot of stand-up. But I like them both. And I don't know if I answered your question, Hobson.
No, you did. You absolutely 100% did. We can talk about stand-up in a minute as well, actually. But very quickly, I just have to say, you have the best ring and string routine in the world, as far as I'm concerned. Like, nothing else touches it.
Well, my very first lecture that I ever saw was Dan Fleshman. And Dan is amazing. If you've never spoken to Dan on this channel, I recommend it.
Yeah, I really should, because I'm a huge fan of Dan Fleshman. And
so you talk about an influence. So I had read a lot of books and seen a lot of things. I saw him when I was like 17 years old. This guy blew my mind. It was like magic on a whole nother level. Like, he did a cups and balls routine, and I kind of knew how cups and balls were, but he finishes with five finales that I did not see coming at all. Wow. Not a one of them. He blew me away. He was the first one I ever saw a coin, you know, fly up in the air, do the muscle pass. When he does a matrix, he would do a matrix barehanded, no cards, and the coins would travel across. He was the first one I ever saw do the rollover coin production. We take a card, and as you roll it over, a coin's produced every time. I mean, just his magic, and his ring and string was phenomenal. And so I took different pieces of different routines and kind of made them my own. And then I've added some things that are uniquely mine that I just learned to tweak them to make them a little bit better, a little bit slicker. So
that's amazing. That's fantastic. And anyone who's not seen it should check your ring and string out. It's brilliant. How did, you know, I want to talk about a few other things, but first of all, let's talk about the Bamboozlers series of books, which are just great. Like, where did that concept come from? Because we've got four books that have been released over a period of time. And obviously, you've now got a bundle that you can buy, and you've got the Bamboozler's deck. And where did this concept come from? How did you?
Yeah, so I've always been fascinated with puzzles and bar betches, and you know, some of my favorite magicians growing up were guys like Harry Anderson. You know, I used to watch him on not just Night Court, but also Cheers, where he was Harry the Hat. And did you know that he was only supposed to be on one episode of Cheers? No. But they loved him so much that they kept having him back. I think he was on there like 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
And he's from this area. So he was kind of a little bit of a myth, a legend, you know, that I just never got to meet, just heard about. And I also studied a lot of books by Martin Gardner. And my favorite magic book of all time, without a doubt, is the Encyclopedia of Impromptu Magic.
Right.
Because it's like 500 pages. And on every page, there's about 5 to 10 different effects. Martin's very succinct in his descriptions. He just has a paragraph and is like, gives you this. And here's another idea. And I always loved that book. And so when I was working restaurants, I found that bar bets came in handy a lot. And here's why, because whenever you would perform for someone, they go, can you teach me that? Can you teach me something? Instead of being a jerk, instead of going, no, I'm not going to teach you this. I go, hey, let me show you something you can do. And I'd show them a bar bet. I'd leave them with a little puzzle. And if they couldn't figure it out, I would show them the answer. And you know what? As soon as I started doing that, my tips increased. Wow. Because I was giving them something and they were giving me something. Mm-hmm. Well, the more I gave them, they started to give me. They go, do you know this one? And they'd show me something that I'd never seen before. So I started keeping notes. And so, or like if I had a repairman come to the house, I remember one time I showed a repairman who was fixing my refrigerator, like a little bar trick. And he goes, do you know this one? And he put a dime on the table and put a plate next to it. He goes, you got to get the dime in the plate, but you can't touch it. And I was like, I've never seen this. I don't know how to do this. And the secret is to come up from underneath the table and blow until the dime flies into the plate. And so I put that in one of the Bamboozler books. I've never seen that in a book anywhere. And so I just collected these things. And then I knew that I wanted the book to be pocket-sized. Mm-hmm. So that way, you know, if you were out on a night on the town, you could have these little bar betches in your pocket because you're not going to remember them all. And you could just crack it open. You could flip through. And once you see the illustration, you go, oh, yeah, I remember what to do now. And so I designed them to look like little Bibles, little pocket size, you know, Bibles. And there's 75 tricks in each one. And so Martin Gardner and I became friends the last 10 years of his life. And so I had him write the foreword to the first book. Because he was always a big influence on my magic too. So
that's brilliant. That's amazing. Wow. And we've had 4 of them out now, which 75 tricks a book. That's 300 bar bets.
It's more than bar bets, actually. There's a lot of impromptu magic. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of stunts. But the last book, Bamboozlers 4, probably has... The books have grown in size. Like the first volume was 128 pages. Volume 4 is 188 pages. But they're all still 75 effects. But I've learned that the routines are getting meatier. Like I'm giving them more, you know, substance and more pattern, more jokes. But also lengthier bits of mentalism. There's a lot of mentalism in these books too that's impromptu. So,
wow. And is there going to be a number 5?
So my plan is this, is to take all 4 volumes, jam them all into one big volume, and add 33 more effects to have the big one. So it'll be 333 effects all in one big book. Because the problem I'm now having is that there's 4 volumes. I order these things 2,000 books at a time. Well, sometimes I have, you know, 400 of volume 1 and 1,500 of volume 3, and it gets hard to keep the numbers straight. So I think I'm just going to let the others slowly go out of print when this bigger book comes out. I may keep volume 1 and 2 alive, but the others I'm going to have to let go because one, I just don't have the storage space to keep storing them. And I just want to sell the bigger complete book in the future, I think. So.
Wow. And do you have a release date for that? Is that something?
No, because I just, volume four took me 9 years.
I can imagine it takes so long. I can imagine, especially as you've bought three other volumes out before that. I mean, and wow.
Well, they're for every effect. That's what I wanted to do different than in the Impromptu book. Was Martin's book, there's an illustration or two on every page, but there's like 10 effects on every page. So mine, I made sure there was an illustration or two for every effect, so that you could almost learn it from the books. I mean, from the illustrations, from the pictures. And every, we take, me and the artist take photographs of my hands. He draws them. And then once he sends them to me, I touch up every single illustration pixel by pixel until it's just the way I want. And so it takes forever to get these things just the way I want. Wow. I'm a perfectionist. I also have OCD. I'm very bad about my OCD.
Well, you know, that's going to lead to a better magic book, though, at the end of the day. I think it's absolutely perfect. Wow. And do you have any tip? I mean, you've created and released so much magic. I mean, outside of the Bamboozler's books and Pocketful of Miracles, the individual tricks that you've published, the individual routines, the downloads, you have created and produced so much magic over the years. Do you have, there's a lot of people that get into magic that want to be creators themselves, that want to create their own magic, whether it be for their show or to ultimately release to, you know, other magicians through a magic shop or whatever. Do you have any advice on that creative process?
Well, just take lots of notes. Every time you have an idea, write it down. And there's a saying in like acting, you know, it's like when in doubt, act it out. So you need to go through the motions. Like if I have a routine that I'm going to do that I know is a restaurant trick, I will suit up. I will put on the pants and jacket that I'll be wearing because I want to know where's everything going to go. Knowing what goes in my pockets already, where is this going to fit in? How is it going to work? Where does my hands naturally go when I'm doing this? So I can think about the vanish of an object or the appearance of something or to make something change. So I want all my body movements to be natural. But creating is like writing books does not come easy for me. I mean, I've got 7 on the market now, but those are all, you know, labor intensive. And it's hard for me to get that quiet space. So it's like a workout routine. You have to set your clock and say, okay, from 10 to 11 today, it's office time. And all I'm going to do is write or create or rehearse magic. You have to be disciplined. And right now, like I have a physical trainer for working out. Like I've been doing that a couple of years. You don't have a physical trainer, you know, for your magic. So it takes a lot of discipline. And you just got to force yourself to do it. You just got to make time for what you think is important.
Wow. Wow. That's great advice. That really is. Oof. Okay. So I've got a couple more questions for you. You mentioned earlier on about how you do more stand-up shows now than anything else. Or you do a lot of stand-up shows. A question I get on this channel all the time again is how to transition from close-up to stage or from close-up to doing a stand-up show in front of a group of people. Because there is a massive world of difference between approaching a table of 3 or 4 people in a restaurant and walking out cold to a group of 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100, 200 people that don't know who you are and grabbing their attention. And a lot of close-up magicians really get nervous just thinking about taking that leap. But I personally think that there are so many skills that you learn when you learn stand-up that can be transferred to a close-up magician. And I, as somebody who's successfully done it, is there any advice that you can give?
I don't think that there's that much of a difference, really. because I don't use a table when I perform, hardly never. So to me, when I'm doing magic restaurant table side, it's still stand up. Mm. I've just only got a group of 4 to 8 people. Now, when you have a crowd that's larger, like I did a party last night for like 50 people, it was a stand up show. Obviously, just your effects need to be a little bit bigger. So you got to think about what's visual. I want to have a mix in my show. I love card magic, but I don't want my show to be card heavy because I know I love it, but not everybody does. So I do things like splash bottle production, because that's something you can do to music. Come out, pop the balloon, and, you know, wine appears. Mm. Something I've been using a lot lately is I do a bottle production. It's I think it's actually I'm trying to think of his name. He invented Pat Page, his bottle production.
Oh yeah.
That was also made popular by Barry Richardson in his book Theater of the Mind. So I teach it in Bamboozlers 4, and I give credit where credit's due. But I use that in conjunction with a digital force bag.
Okay, wow.
So I have somebody, because that way it becomes a mentalism effect plus a revelation. So I'll have someone, pick a number. They go to my list, they scroll up and down, they see there's a bunch of different beers or whatever. And whatever the beer is, as I take off my jacket, I pull that beer out of my sleeve. And so you've got, it's a double effect. And wow. So you just got to think about how to make things longer, like, and more visual and bigger. You know, you got to think about what's going to play to a crowd. But also I like to do little intimate bits of magic in my parlor or stand-up show, because I think people have a finer appreciation for sleight of hand magic and mind reading magic than they, I don't know. There's a lot of magic out there that I think is bubblegum for the eyes. And I think we need to avoid that. That's good for TikTok. It's good for, you know, social media, but you've got to have, you want them to care. You want them to listen. You want to be the reason they put down their fork. And so halfway through my show, I tell a little bit of my story. Like, I don't tell my story. I don't tell them, I don't give myself an introduction. I just say my name. I address why I'm there, and the magic begins. And not till I'm more than halfway through the show do I start to tell them my story. I tell them about, you know, being able to do magic since I was a kid, having cancer, studying psychology, and, you know, wanting to work for the Secret Service. And then I start to get more into the mind reading stuff. And they're like, it almost feels like they see the evolution of me becoming, you know, almost like Sherlock Holmes. And then all of a sudden I start to do Sherlock Holmes like things, and it gets the reaction like is double, you know, because I set the stage for them to want that and believe that. And a lot of it's true. A lot of what I'm saying is true. A lot of it is showmanship and creativity as well. So.
Wow. And on that subject as well, one thing that you mentioned at the very beginning of the interview, you talked about how your dad was a pool hustler and you kind of lent into that. Is that something that you've kept going as a character? You know, you talked about how you take a step back and you talk about your story. The reason I ask is, before we did the interview, I was looking on your shop and there's photos that you can buy of you, you know, looking like a pool hustler and looking like a card hustler. Is that a character that you've created that's kind of continued through your career?
Well, I think I've morphed into what people have expected of me and what comes naturally, because those worlds I understand. I play 5 tournaments of poker a week for the last 6 years.
Wow. Like,
and I do that for the sport and for the psychology of it. Like, I'm really interested. Like, it's crazy. It almost is like mind reading when you can look at someone and you go, he's got King 10. You just know what he has. Like, I can tell he's bluffing right now. I can tell that was a position bet. Like, you just know it, those things become instinct. With pool, yes, I do play a lot of pool, and I'm pretty good at it. But I hold back. I don't play it all the time, but when I need to put on a good pool game, I can do it. What's funny is I didn't become Diamond Jim. I was always just Jim. I wasn't Diamond Jim until I was like 16, because my stepfather, every time he saw me do magic, he'd say, "Hey, Hollywood, hey, Diamond Jim." I thought, oh, that's got a good ring to it, because diamond's my birthstone. It conjures up images of a con man, a cheat. It's much more fun to say. It's much more memorable. I mean, who doesn't want Diamond Jim at their party? That's a very braggadocious handle to moniker yourself with. And so I've learned that it's helped me with my competition, because there's guys in town that I compete with, but they forget their names. They remember my name because it's just, there's something catchy about it. And so that served me well with name branding for my products, for my shows. So it's funny that I'm becoming what everyone thinks Diamond Jim really is. I mean, the real Jim is shy and inward and quiet. If I don't have a joke to tell or a routine to perform, it's hard for me to relate to a lot of people. I don't follow sports. I just got hired to do Jason Kidd's birthday party. I had to fly back from Blackpool early for that. I didn't know who the hell Jason Kidd was. He's the coach for the Dallas Mavericks. And Mark Cuban was there, and they, you know, it was a great show. They had fun. But I don't know who these people are. And my friends are like, what? You're like, cause they all follow sports. I perform for every Dallas Cowboys quarterback that has ever been. I've been to Jerry Jones's house a few times. I mean, my clients are millionaires and billionaires. And I don't know, somehow for over 37 years, I literally made a name for myself. So
that's amazing. You know, when you're making a name for yourself and you're putting yourself out there, and obviously you've been incredibly successful at this, how do you go around branding yourself or creating this person that everybody wants to book?
I think it's just, you've got to want, your goal needs to be, you know, people used to tell me, I remember when I was a kid in school that we'd go to a party and they go, oh, this party's boring. And I learned real quick that you should never go anywhere looking for fun. You need to be the fun that arrives. Mm-hmm. And so I always try, that mindset is, I'm going to make this fun for them right now. Even though I'm not working, I'm going to do something fun. So I'm always on with a joke. I've always got magic at the ready to perform for people. And so I think people just like people that are enigmatic and fun and confident. And so a lot of guys, well, I'm not getting paid, I'm not going to do magic. It's like, you're thinking about it the wrong way. You know, you've got to give to get. And because I really do believe what you give out comes back to you tenfold. So it means the world to me to hear these nice things that you say that I didn't know. And I have people like from Scam School, Scam Nation. You know, that's a show that's been on for 12 years and it's got a couple million followers. I have people all the time. It's like, man, you got me started in magic. And like, it's hard for me to fathom, to believe, but,
That's great. That's great. That's awesome. And here's a question for you. One last question. What's left? I mean, we've talked about your career. You everything that you've achieved, you've done at a very high level. You've been very successful as a restaurant magician. You've been very successful as a corporate magician, very successful as a magician in general. You've literally written the book 7 times over. You've created and sold best-selling magic tricks. You've lectured all over the world.
I need new goals.
Yeah, like, what is there left to do? Is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you haven't achieved or that you want to do? I know we've talked about the big book, but outside of that.
Yeah, there are. There's personal goals. I'm a globetrotter, so I do like to see the world. I'm going to try to hit do another Asia tour next year just to knock out some more countries that I haven't seen. And then I'm going to start knocking out the continents. I want to hit Antarctica. And so my fiance and I, we just got engaged like 6 weeks ago. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, she's a jet pilot. And so she travels the world and she's a badass. She trains other jet pilots.
Amazing.
Yeah, I know. I thought I had a cool job. So she wants to do like a mind, health, and body kind of retreat place for people to come. So we want to build a place that's ours and then have that for her. And then adjacent to it will be a magic theater. It's also maybe a speakeasy. Also, I collect pinball machines. Right now I have 11 of them. So I want to have like a pinball, you know, room with a bar, maybe some guest bedrooms. It's a place that maybe I could Airbnb by, you know, separately or do my shows or rent out the theater. So yeah, I've got lots of goals, lots of lofty things that are going to cost a lot of money, but yeah, those are the things that I'm working towards right now. I want people to come to me instead of me coming to them.
That's great. Well, you know, it's been done before. And, Magicopolis, Thieves Spill, you know, the Chicago Magic Lounge. There's so many places that...
There's a lot. There's a lot. Paul Gertner, I know, has a place. There's a lot of magicians. Ossie Wind is doing his show. Like, yeah, people want that. They want to have an intimate, magic, close-up experience. And what I'm working towards, and this is the hard part, I want to tell stories in the show, stories that hit home, that are personal, and also just fantastical stories, but I want magic to happen to them even after they've left the theater. Like once they get in their car, maybe something happens. Maybe when they get home, something happens. I want magic to follow them home. And so I've got all kinds of ideas and plans for that. So,
oh, wow, that sounds great. That sounds awesome. Okay, so lots of big goals then.
Yeah, lots of goals.
That's brilliant. That's fantastic. And a couple of quick fire questions before we finish.
Yeah.
So we talked about the Bamboozlers series. You've done a couple of Penguin Lives, haven't you? And from memory serves me, one of them was based on the Bamboozler series. And from memory, it was an incredible lecture. Like, did you have fun doing those? And are they still about?
Yeah, I was very proud. I used to tour with Penguin and do their Penguin Live events. I did that several times. And that was always fun. And then my first lecture, where I lectured from Pockets Full of Miracles and other things, routines like Sweet, like you mentioned. I was very proud. I was actually taken aback. For the longest time, it was their highest, only 5-star ranked product on their whole website. I think some other guys have surpassed me now, but for a long time, I know it's still up there in the top 10 or whatever, but I think it's because my magic is commercial. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of it, where most guys teach 5 or 10 routines, I taught 20. And so people just, I felt like they got more for their money. And so they asked me back. So I wanted to top myself. So I was like, okay, what can I do that no one else has done? I thought I'll make it all barbettes and I'll do 40 of them. And so I did that and it was well received, not as well as the first one. I think a lot of people watch that expecting to learn more magic. And so they might have been disappointed because they didn't read that it was a barbette lecture. But I can't help it that people can't read. So
I genuinely think, though, if you're a commercial close-up worker, especially in restaurants and bars, you need to have a bunch of barbettes under your, you know.
Well, Yeah, people say that bar bets and puzzles aren't magic. Maybe. I tend to disagree sometimes. There was a lady, my fiance's best friend, was at the house last night, and I handed her a puzzle. And as soon as she solved it, it's just a two-piece puzzle. And once she solved it, she like screamed with joy, like she was happy, like it was a magical moment for her. So puzzles can be magic, and it's about entertaining people. Mm-hmm. Like I say, these bar bets can be left with people. So the way I would use them is I would leave them with a bar bet as I go entertain the next group, and then I come back to check on them. How'd you do? Did you figure it out? If they did, they had the satisfaction of solving it, and if they didn't, I gave them the answer, and so they wanted to give me something in return. So I think bar bets and puzzles can be very lucrative if you use them in the right way. If you're using it to try to hustle people and take their money, which is actually something I've never done, people think I do, but I haven't, then yeah, you know, you might get some kickback on that.
Well, as somebody who's written the book on bar bets and then some, and obviously has talked now about how much poker and pool you play, and your dad is a pool hustler, I can understand why people think that you might do that occasionally.
Yeah, what's funny is my reputation precedes me, because people will not let me deal when I sit down at a poker table, and they're just afraid. You know, they know me. They know that I would never cheat. But they're just, yeah, it scares people when they find out you're a magician. So what's funny is when I play poker and there's strangers among the table, I don't tell them I'm a magician. The old joke is that if they find out you're a magician, they'll think you're cheating if you win. But if you lose, they think you're a bad magician. That's the joke. But what I do as a psychological ploy is halfway through, I will do something or say something to let them know I'm a magician, especially if there's a break, I'll do magic. And now I've got the psychological advantage, because like when I bet and it's a big bet, they're like, well, shit, he must have, he's a magician. Like,
yeah, that makes sense. You know, you don't see many magicians that study psychology. That's something that you've come back to during this interview over and over again. You know, your understanding of psychology, both through what you studied at college and your degree, and also what you've studied outside of that. How important is it for a magician to have a grasp of human nature and psychology as a performer? Is that an important thing, do you think?
Oh, I think it's very important. I think we all have an innate understanding. Like, it helps me to read the room when I walk in, because I know instantly who's going to be the best volunteer for this, or who am I going to choose to think of this or do this. Yeah, it's very important. I think we should all study acting. We should take improv comedy classes. All these things only make you better. Read as much psychology as you can and magic. Like, why, when you ask someone like the most famous painting in the world, most people would say the Mona Lisa, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but why?
Because it's the one that everyone talks about.
Right, but and why was everyone talking about it? Did you know that it was stolen from the Louvre at one time?
No.
Yeah, and it went missing for many, many, many years. And all people read in the paper for years was, where's the missing Mona Lisa? And it turns out an Italian janitor who worked at the Louvre thought this belongs in our country, not in a French museum. So he came up with a plan to steal it and took it. And the dummy left it in his apartment. And he talked about it. And years later, he was caught and it was returned. And of course, when it was returned, it's like the Mona Lisa has returned to the Louvre. And so for years and years and years, it got all this publicity. So the painting that got the most publicity in the world was the Mona Lisa. And that's why we talk about it. It's not the greatest painting in the world. It's all right. It's small. Have you ever seen it? It's tiny.
No, I never have.
Yeah, but it's because it got the most publicity.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, and it just it became part of pop culture. And so it's the thing that everyone talked about, you know, in TV and plays. And so it's just, when you hear it so many times, like, yeah, you, if you ask someone to name a famous painting, you can guarantee that it's going to be in the top five.
Yeah.
Probably one. So. Wow. So it's important to know things like that. I've been doing a lot of movie prediction type stuff where I have people think of certain movies. And it's amazing to me how many of the same movies are named over and over again. Like, I actually have a list now. Really? And so I've come up with a routine where I have a prediction. It's a card on the table. And since it's so common that certain movies are named, then when I open up the card, it plays music, and the music is the theme from the show that they think of.
Wow.
And I have different versions of that depending on what movie they choose, but I'm ready to do it like with several different movies at one time. Yeah. So it's like those greeting cards you open up to play music. I do it with a playing card. I open it up and it plays music, but now I hand it to them and it doesn't play music. So they're baffled. Where was it coming from? And how the hell did he know what movie I was going to think of? And so,
that's incredible.
Yeah. So I love studying that sort of stuff and just trying things. And just here's what's crazy is the more you study psychology, you really feel like you can read minds. It's come to pass many, many times where I ask someone to think of a card and I tell myself, okay, when she says five of hearts in a minute, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give her not just one ending. I'm going to give her three endings. And then they say the five of hearts and I do the three endings. But I just look at them and I know what they're about to say because of things I've done to lead them to that decision. And it happens all the time to me.
Wow. That's insane. That's incredible. So where can people learn how to, I mean, obviously you went to college, you've got a degree in this, and it's something that you're passionate about. So you spend a lot of time thinking about it. But if somebody wants to like spend more time learning this subject, what would they
do? Yeah, there's a lot of audiobooks on things like NLP and different psychology and just profiling. You know, when people, the way they look sometimes, if they hold their breath or, you know, micro expressions that appear on their face. I'll tell you how I do the five of hearts thing. And it happens all the time. It's usually a young lady. And I could tell that they don't know anything about cards because I've done some card magic and they're just not comfortable around them. I get that vibe. Like they don't know anything about cards. And so that's the person I'm going to ask to think of a card. I go, I want you to think of a card. And I'm like, oh, okay. I go, is it a club? Is it a heart? And they're like, heart. I go, is it an ace? Is it a two? Is it a three? Is it a four? Is it a five? And they're like, five. And so it's like magician's choice with words where I've forced them to say the five of hearts. And it works more often than not.
Wow, that's like miracle status.
Yeah. And it's just, it's leading. It's like the classic course with words. So yeah, all you guys try it. And that's my gift to you. Just try more things like that and you'll be surprised how often they work. So
that's great. And what happens if something like that doesn't work? You have an out, obviously. You have.
Yeah, you have outs. I always have an invisible deck in my pocket in case something goes wrong. But, okay. But yeah, I can. There's so many miracle stories, things that have happened to me over the years. It's insane. So.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. That really is. And one last question, which is probably, I think, about the seventh one last question I've asked you at this point.
But hey, Columbo.
Yeah, I can't stop asking questions. It's fascinating. You talked about how much poker you now play. Mm-hmm. Do you incorporate that into your magic? Like, do you do gambling demonstrations? And
No, I talk about it. I think I should. It's something I'm thinking about adding to a show. But the problem with that is I need a table and I'm so used to performing without a table. So in my, there's from time to time, I will rent a theater and sell tickets to a show for my fans and friends to come see me. And I had used a table to do some, you know, card magic that requires it. And I do magic to the, like, the music from The Sting. But so, yes, I have done a little bit of that. And so when I build the show that I want to design in my theater, I actually want to have three or four different shows that are each an hour long. So that way, if they see the A show, they know the next week is the B show if they want to come back, or the next night is the B show. So that way, if they're in town that weekend, they can see two different shows by me. And if they come back in town, they might see a different one. So, and I want to add elements of close-up magic like that, gambling routines. But tell us, I want to have a story to tell. And there is some stories that I do tell now, but I want to enhance them and make them, I don't know what the word is. I want to create a show more like in and of itself, not a one-man play like his was so much, but more heartfelt stories. They don't have to be about me, but just things that people can relate to. I want people to cry. I want people to laugh. I want people to be afraid. I want all of that in the show.
Wow. That's great. That's fantastic. And that brings us back to, obviously, eventually having your own theater and speakeasy where you can actually,
I'm big on like understanding like phobias and fears as well. Like as a little kid, I had a spider come from my ceiling. Like I watched it in slow motion come down. And then when it landed on me, it bit me. And of course, for the longest time, I was afraid of spiders. So when I was 15, I bought a pet tarantula and I had that thing for 10 years. And it took me about a year before I could really ever let it crawl on me. But I'm big on like conquering my fears. And like, I just swam with sharks for the first time this so I've always been deathly afraid of sharks, but now I'm not so afraid, you know. So I understand like, why do we fear certain things? Well, why do we remember certain things?
That's insane. You're scared of spiders, so you go and get a spider. You're scared of sharks, you go and swim with sharks. That's mad. That's taking it to the extreme there, man. Well,
when you've had cancer and you feel like you're going to die, every day's a gift. So life is short. You might as well just, you know, cross off as many things as you can off your list before it's too late. So
that is the best advice that I've ever heard. Live life, you know, to the max. And if you want to try and do something, don't put it off, but do it, right?
No, don't put it off. There is no tomorrow.
That's great. That's amazing. This has been one of my favorite interviews, genuinely. No, seriously. Like I say, you've always been an inspiration to me, but you know, you're such a, as well as being so incredibly talented, you're such a nice guy as well, which is amazing. And it's so great. If people want to buy all of your stuff, where can they go? You have a magic shop. It's
DJ.com, and that website's good. It's soon to be renovated, but I'm proud. It looks great now, but it's going to get a lot better real soon. So I'm going to add some more things to it. But yeah, there's like a lot to find on there. There's my dice, there's books, there's downloads.
Well, we didn't even talk about the dice. The dice that you sell are just incredible.
Thanks. Yeah. What's funny is it's like, even my products are becoming more like con man. Like I have marked cards and loaded dice, and they're actually not loaded, but they're misnumbered dice for magicians for forcing. And I'm really proud of my marked cards that Phil Smith helped me design. I think they're some of the easiest readers.
I'm very good friends with Phil Smith.
Oh, he's great.
I consider him a genius when it comes to anything, but especially marking systems. Like, it's just ridiculous the things that that man can do. Just ridiculous.
He's amazing. I knew he was the guy to work with because he created the DMC deck, the best-selling, like marked deck out there. So I like the DMCs, but I really love mine. I think the DMCs are awesome. So
well, we can't get them anymore.
Oh, you can't.
Oh, wow. Drummond and Phil went their separate ways.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear
that. The MC deck is no longer a thing. So,
well, you guys better grab them up while you can, because they're awesome. Look for them. But when you can't find those, the Diamond Mark cards are...
I have to be honest. I've never seen... I'm going to jump on your website now, because I've never seen your...
The market will blow your mind. It's incredible. It's like his. It's like the magic eye. You don't see it at first, and then you can't unsee it once you see it. So,
wow. I need to go...
And Brushwood was kind enough to help me promote it and create like a puzzle box around it. We created a really cool puzzle box to go with them if people are interested. So,
really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, check out the site. And the Bamboozler deck, too. There's an awesome puzzle box that I designed that uses a Labyrinth. You have to get the ball through the maze to open the box the right way. So,
I'm just looking at the the website now. I mean, it's amazing. There's so much stuff on there that I completely forgot about. I completely forgot that you did some Dover books.
Yeah, so that's why I have so many books. I've written 5 books. I wrote Pockets Full of Miracles and Bamboozlers 1-4. But then with Dover, they wanted to reprint. I leased them the rights to Pockets Full of Miracles, which became Close Up Magic Secrets. They wanted it to have a more generic title. And first I was opposed to it, but then I was like, no, wait a minute. People will think I've written another book. That's not a bad thing. And they've sold the heck out of that online, Barnes & Noble, places like that. Then I took a lot of magic out of the Bamboozler books to create a magic book for them. I took a lot of bar bets out of the books to create a bar bet book for them. So that's why it looks like I have so many books. So technically I've written 5, but then there's been some spinoffs because of those. So.
Wow. Yeah. And there's I forgot about Diamante as well, which is an incredible 3-card Monty routine. People need to just go onto your site and just buy everything. I'm them all, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's great.
Thank you. I was very flattered. I was doing Diamante at the Blackpool booth this year, and I blew Gayton Bloom's mind with it. And what's funny is I used to study his stuff. Like I used to do one of his Monty routines. But I think what gets guys is they're certain they know what the gaff is at the end. And then I hand them the 3 cards and there's no gaff. And then they're just, you just see their brain just.
Well, if you can get Gayton Bloom, then that's a huge endorsement, right?
Yeah, he was very kind. He was nice.
Amazing. That's amazing. And have you got, before we wrap this up, when we're talking about your products here, is there any, we've talked about your books, are there any physical products that you're going to be bringing out in the future? Are you, because I know you lecture a lot.
I'm lecturing less and less and less, actually. I'm so focused on performing and staying closer to home right now and doing my corporate events, because when I lecture, it basically pays my bills to travel. And I've done all that. And so I just want to stay closer to home and build this theater, build this homestead, and build a place that people can come. And so, yeah, my products are just maybe books, maybe some downloads. I've always got 20 projects on my board. There is another deck of cards that I'd like to create, something that would appeal to a mass audience. I've always sold at least like 10,000 or more decks of what I've created in the past, from the Bamboozler deck, the Diamond Mark cards, to the Doomsday deck. But this one that I have in mind, I think will eclipse all of those. Like, I think it would sell 10 times as much, because it'll have a mass appeal, not just a magic appeal.
Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah, I think so. I'm taking notes and getting all my ducks in a row right now for it. So it's going to be a big project.
So basically, just keep watching. Is there a mailing list on the website that we can sign up to?
Not really. Just if they go to, they can hop on my Facebook and friend my friend page, not my fan page. I'm not as good at social media as I should be. So if you want to keep track of me, Facebook is the best way, and maybe Instagram. You know, a lot of people like to use Facebook, some Twitter, some Google, some YouTube. You know, there's a site that combines all of them, and it saves you time. Yeah, it's a you Googling Twitface. And if you type in you Googling Twitface.com, you know what? It takes you to my website.
That's great. That's funny.
I use that in my show. That's how I end my show. Because the joke is something they will remember. So that means they're more likely to remember to go to my website. So it's like I'm basically telling them to go to my site, and they do. So
that's brilliant. That's brilliant. That little tip there. Perfect. Jim, this has been an incredible interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the channel. I really appreciate it. It's just been brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If you're watching this, here's what I want you to do. Do me a favor. Leave a comment down below. Let Jim know what you thought of the interview. Go on to his website. Again, that website is DJ Tyler. That's D for Delta, J for Juliet, Tyler, Tango, Yankee, Lima, Echo, Romeo, DJTyler.com. Go check out the Magic Shop. Everything on there is absolutely fantastic. Go spend some money. It's all really good. And leave a comment down below. And I'm sure we'll be seeing you again very, very soon. But Diamond Jim Tyler, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Guys, he's amazing. On behalf of Diamond Jim Tyler, thank you so much for checking out the interview. And we'll see you again soon right here on Magic TV.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.